Right. Well, thank you very much for coming. I will be talking about a number of algorithms that we've been working on at Durham that facilitate simulation of large spin systems. That is, before we even start doing optimal control on a system, the assumption that we usually make, and that's a big assumption, is that we can simulate that spin system or another dynamical system. And as you well know, simulations scale exponentially with the number of particles, be they spins or something else. And really beyond 5 particles or so, problems start. And we've been looking at ways of solving those problems. Now, because I come from the chemistry department, you will see through the talk perhaps the reason for my militant pragmatism, because in chemistry we do have to deliver, as it were, a product to the funding agencies, and it has to be applicable to a chemical or biological system that's out there. To start with a little bit of prologue, I've dug this wonderful piece out quite recently. It's a letter from L.H. Thomas to Goudsmit, one of the people who originally proposed spin. I don't know if you can read this, but it says, "I think you and Uhlenbeck have been very lucky to get your spinning electron published and talked about before Pauli heard of it. It appears that more than a year ago, Kronig believed in the spinning electron and worked out something. The first person he showed it to was Pauli. Pauli ridiculed the whole thing so much that the first person also became the last, and no one else heard anything of it. Which all goes to show that the infallibility of the deity does not extend to his self-styled vicar on Earth." So Pauli, who ironically inherited, well, gave his name to the matrices, actually initially ridiculed the whole thing as sheer impossibility. Okay, but back to spin dynamics, that's the introduction to the field. It's comprised of nuclear magnetic resonance, dealing with the dynamics of nuclei, protein structure determination, molecular structure determination in general, chemical kinetics, and it's generally probably the most powerful spectroscopic technique in existence. You put in a protein solution into your magnet, and a couple of days later, if everything goes to plan, you have a three-dimensional atomic structure rotating on your screen. Electron spin resonance, doing essentially the same for an electron spin. Interactions are usually essentially anisotropic in ESR. Instrumentation is somewhat more sophisticated, and relaxation theory plays a much greater role in ESR than it does in NMR. We can definitely no longer ignore it. Then perhaps the most famous field, magnetic resonance imaging, dealing with non-invasive imaging of various objects using the magnetic nuclei. This is not a physical slice, that's an imaging slice, so no cucumbers were harmed in this work. But it borrows the signal from NMR, and it borrows the contrast agents from ESR. And finally, the field that probably few people have heard about, and the one we are working in, magnetochemistry and magnetobiology, dealing with magnetic field effects on chemical reactions and anisotropic chemical yield patterns as you rotate the reaction system relative to the magnetic field. Now, the current simulation capabilities is about this. If you do honest relaxation theory and work in Liouville space, that's about the biggest we can do. And that's even on a supercomputer. And that's the magnetoreceptor. That's the molecule that demonstrates an isotropic magnetic response in its chemical yield, the one we recently published. And you can see the sheer size of this beast. That's how the instruments look like. Enormous magnet with a tiny sample. This is a couple of centimeters across. Lasers, sometimes for optical pumping, various pieces of tubes, but essentially supercon magnet electronics workstation and laser equipment. A bit more on the laser side, this is how you get the light into that tiny sample for photochemical pumping, if any, so fiber optical setups of various sorts that we worked on in the past. And returning to the magnetochemistry and the reason why it all started, this is something called chemically induced dynamic nuclear polarization, which actually generates intermolecular two-electron entanglements and uses them for NMR magnetization pumping. That's the brief schematic. You have a photosensitizer molecule. You have a photon which flies into it. photo excites it, the excited state undergoes electron transfer, forming something called a spin-correlated radical pair, but in the language of people present, the two-electron singlet entanglement. That entanglement evolves, and it evolves dependent on the nuclear spin states, so essentially the nuclear spin states are sorted between reaction products, result being a molecule with polarized nuclear spins, which then emits the radio frequency photon which flies into our detector, and experimentally we see the enhancement of the observable signal. Now, so it is two-particle entanglement which in practice in a real chemical system sorts the spins up from down. So essentially cyclic magnetosensitive reaction chain which pumps nuclear magnetization under optical pumping. The origin, as I said, is recombination probability modulation by nuclear hyperfine interaction. So the fate of the entanglement depends on nuclear spin states. The applications are protein folding. You can investigate surface structure, chemically pumped NMR, and chemical kinetics, because those radicals usually are quite interesting. That's an application of it, green fluorescent protein. The chemistry I've shown only happens on the protein surface, so you can track what happens to the surface in real time as the protein folds, and you can see some signals vanish, others appear, and that essentially corresponds to the amino acids being exposed and buried on the surface as the protein folds. So you can say that these particular tyrosines, for example, are on the surface of the protein. The theory of that is rather well developed. I'll be talking at great lengths about that theory, but essentially you add pumping terms to the Liouville von Neumann's equation, and you can experimentally watch your signal go higher and higher up. Another application and another reason for this work, I'm trying to steer the subsequent discussion from the whether it works domain into the why it works domain, because the algorithms described do actually work in these systems. Electron transfer in photosystem 1, you may know that photosynthetic systems generate two electron entanglements routinely. And in photosynthetic systems, you have one electron here and another electron sitting here, preserving the singlet entanglement between them. And the evolution of that entanglement is related to the distance, which you can extract from the molecule, which eventually maps the electron transfer path throughout this photosystem 1. And this is the actual quantum bits of the singlet entanglement that you detect. A slightly unexpected application. As I said, some of those reactions show anisotropic magnetic response. The yield changes with the orientation. And it was originally thought to be just a curious phenomenon until the biologists came and conjectured that, well, because they know that birds do sense the Earth's magnetic field and use it for navigation, they conjecture that something similar birds might be using. Proof of principle has been done using this. Well, it's a non-biological molecule, of course, but it's the one which does show anisotropic, magnetically anisotropic chemical reactivity. And again, you see the sheer number of spins here. I mean, every single ellipsoid is the chemical, is the hyperfine tensor. And again, using traditional techniques, it is not possible to simulate spin dynamics in this system. This cube is frontier orbitals in there. We've done some calculations, predicted that the magnetic sense in biological organisms should be disrupted if you irradiate them at certain radio frequency. So biologists actually took the birds and released them from airplanes and shown the radio frequency on them and found that indeed the orientation is disrupted, plus some very unhappy birds. And the final piece of application before we go on to theory is cancer diagnostics. This is the so-called MRI contrast agent. And the detection mechanism there is that the tumor tissue is acidic. And if you make the magnetic properties of this depend on the pH, we published the prototype recently, you can do an MRI and the tumor will be highlighted in red, because the chemical shift of the fluorine nucleus in this case seriously, well, strongly depends on the acidity of the medium. Again, the size of this means that the simulation is not possible unless you work out something, some way around the exponential scaling. Okay, so the exponential scaling problem, you know that the objective in, well, most types of unitary propagation problems in quantum mechanics is to solve either the Schrödinger equation in time domain, or if you're working with an ensemble, the Liouville von Neumann's equation. sometimes formulated through super operators. The operator matrices are generated as direct products of Pauli matrices or whatever basis set you have, and the matrix dimension goes either as 2 to the n by 2 to the n in Hilbert space, or as 4 to the n by 4 to the n in the so-called Liouville space. So fundamentally, no way beyond about 15 spins, and even if you use sparse matrices, you have to at least store the diagonal. So with over 50 spins, even a sparse Hamiltonian cannot so much as be stored, let alone diagonalized. A little bit of introduction into what we mean by Liouville space, jargon busting for the non-NMR people. Hilbert space is where your wave functions live. We all know it and love. It is very rarely used, though, in spin dynamics because it does not account for, it does not adequately account for relaxation, chemical kinetics, and various ensemble properties. So we usually work with density matrices, that is this, and then the Schrödinger equation transforms into the Liouville von Neumann's equation. It's slightly better in that it accounts for most coherent phenomena in the things we're dealing with, but it still ignores many relaxations. So the space that is in fact isomorphous to this but is obtained by stretching the density matrix into a vector is significantly more useful. So if you stretch your density matrix into a vector, then the commutator brackets become super operators. It can be shown that they get this expression. This is known as the Liouvillean, and you can then add relaxation super operator, kinetics super operator, and even though the matrices involved are usually huge, there is a great benefit of very straightforward kinetics and relaxation account here. So typically, the most sophisticated models we have in spin dynamics do use this so-called Liouville space.
I'm wondering, some approximation of this is in my head, but all the details aren't. The expression you can turn in the middle expression in the Hilbert space. We add relaxation terms as well, right?
In principle, you can put R double hat into it. That is, yes, you can add relaxation super operator here, but that essentially makes it a Liouville space expression. It's a four index sum. So yes, in fact, Redfield's original formulation, he put R double hat into here, but that's notational transformation. Super operators belong to Liouville space.
But is there any, I'm trying to understand, is there any difference between just the notation?
There is. If you have the Liouvillean, should I perhaps get the lights on? The Liouvillean as shown, can be expressed as a commutator. So essentially L double hat equals H commutator dot. If you take the relaxation superoperator, R double hat rho, it cannot be expressed as a commutator of anything, at least the density matrix. That is, there is no direct product decomposition for it.
Right, it's a something times a density matrix.
Yes. So such an expression does not exist, and you cannot distill the relaxation superoperator down into the Hilbert space. It essentially belongs to Liouville space. So there is no commutator expression for it.
But is there a computational advantage, though?
It's a huge computational...
Formally, it's prettier, I'm just trying to...
This is 2n by 2n. This is 4n by 4n. So there's a colossal computational disadvantage of going down here. But as I'll show you, once you start restricting your state spaces, this space is much better. And eventually, once you've completed the restriction, the dimension of the Liouvillean becomes smaller than the dimension of the original Hamiltonian.
What about the memory? What you showed us is this R looks like it's Markovian, is that correct?
It is approximately it's derived using Markovian statistics. That is, Redfield's original formulation of the expression for R was that you have in your full-time dependent Hamiltonian H0 plus H1 T, so perturbative formulation, This is big and static. This is small and stochastic. Now, assumption is that the correlation function of this decays exponentially. That is, this is an integral of some Markovian process. Because in principle, correlation function of two Markovian processes should be delta function. But if you take the integral, so yes, there is a Markov chain hidden, and that's a big assumption, but no better assumptions have emerged that lead to solvable theories. Okay, so continuing with Liouville space, each spin has got four possible states corresponding to the four possible products of a spin-up and spin-down function. And you probably recognize the usual Lie algebra that you know and love, the SU2, with the three generators, but it also has something that doesn't belong to the Lie algebra. Lie algebras don't have identity elements, they just have the Lie brackets to work with, but it's an interesting list. You can say that your spin is LZ, L plus, or L minus, but you can also say that it's E, which disclaims all knowledge of that spin. And we'll see how useful that is. So in principle, if you have a three-spin entanglement, or a three-spin coherence, as we call it in NMR, between spin L, spin S, and spin M, but you have two other spins which don't get involved in this particular entanglement, you just put an identity matrix. So any algebraic manipulations, exponentials, propagators do not affect those two spins as a result. But it's easy to see that the dimension of the system state space scales as 4 to the n. So if you have 4 states for one spin, 4 states for another spin, is a 16 states in total. A problem.
Is not the difference between SU2 and U2?
There is a big difference, I think.
No, but isn't that when you add the E back in? The SU2 just...
Lie algebras don't like unit elements. As you know, there is no multiplication operation in Lie algebra. It's just a bracket. So yes, if you take the generators of SU2 and add a unit element to it, you just get the C2, really, the matrix space. So U2 is a subspace of that. It's no longer a Lie algebra. So it's an interesting interplay here. Yes, the state space is a vector space, but it's not a subspace. Subset of it is a Lie algebra, and that's the algebra that we use to propagate the system forward in Hilbert space. I don't know if it makes sense. It's this whole concept of Liouville space has got this fantastic property of one-sided propagation. In density matrices, you know that the propagation is double-sided. So if you propagate forward your density matrix, you have to do this. It's quite clunky, because it's not possible to solve for rho in all cases. Liouville space has got fantastic properties that it's a one-sided propagation. There is no other element, which allows very straightforward solutions for rho. So yes, the generators of this Lie group are these matrices. But they also, once you stretch them, span the state space of your system. And it's fantastic because your propagation, in a sense of a group action, matches literally vector matrix multiplication in the underlying matrix space. Very useful thing to have. And that's something that traditional density matrix spaces don't have. Right, so state space restriction. Clearly, we cannot simulate the system in its entirety. The matrices are just too big. But let's look at...
Just too big. The length language here because there are people from different communities. If you go back one slide, and here you have entanglement order. Before you had this order,
yes.
Entangled. So technically, that's not an entanglement because if you can be written, you can write it as an order. People usually would not call that an entangled state.
In principle, you're right. Yes. Yeah. So multi-spin order would be.
Generalized entangled. It's not the technical.
Yes. But it is a situation where the state of one spin does depend on the state of the other. That is, if you measure this and discover that it's up, that has implications for what the rest are. So in that sense, well, okay, I think you're probably right in that it's a product state, not strictly speaking an entanglement. Right, so what do we do about this huge state space? The states that live in it are the identity operator, they are the generators, they are the products of generators, they are big products of generators. And what this is called in NMR is multiple quantum coherence. It accumulates slowly as your magnetization traverses multiple couplings and generally relaxes extremely fast. So again, with that statement that was just made, it's not strictly speaking an entanglement, but spin orders of order k relax much faster than low spin orders because the relaxation involves interactions of each of the spin entering the combination. Second,
I belong to those people who maybe are not familiar with the way you define entanglement here. So could you please detail it a little bit more? Because I'm not following here.
It's probably a misnomer. It's this direct product state. Are you comfortable with the direct product state?
But the thing which puzzles me, as has been commented, is that direct product state is exactly the opposite of entanglement. So there must be some other concept which you are defining here, which I'm not catching.
I think
we should talk about
it. I think it's my fault in that I've rather loosely used the term.
So
call it product state. Ignore, because if this is how it's defined in your community, then I wouldn't argue. So it's a product state, not an entanglement. Right, so there are these product states which are quite high. A, they relax fast. B, they accumulate slowly. And C, that historical approximations, something called product operator formalism, which ignored the high product states, were quite successful. That is, it is possible to describe most NMR experiments using just low-order product states. So we can try neglecting high and remote spin orders. Another, perhaps, analogy is if you have a 100 spin system, then what's the probability of getting a two-spin order between the two spins on the opposite end ever in the experiment? Well, nil. And if you have a 200 spin system, what's the probability of getting a 200 spin product state? Also nil. They just don't accumulate. So there are states in any large spin systems which, because of temporal constraints of NMR experiments, do not appear. When we started this research, we didn't expect quite how many of them there are. So original operators had this form. If we ignore very high order multi-spin orders, so we only put a few spins in, what happens is you get this number of orders. When you work through the algebra, you find that if k is the maximum order that you are cutting at, and n is the number of spins, it turns out that your scaling has become polynomial in the total number of spins. K is usually 5, 6, or thereabouts. So you started with 4 to the n. If you've done the state space restriction, you end up with n to the k. That's a fundamental difference.
How do you choose k?
I will tell in a moment in more detail, but it is related to the local coupling density. The more spins are coupled to a given spin, the higher orders we go to locally. If it's a linear chain, for example, triples are generally sufficient. If it's something like an amino acid, you sometimes have to go to 8 spin orders to properly describe the magnetization flows through it.
But basically, the k just is the number of spins that you allow to be excited simultaneously.
Yes.
Does your Hamiltonian commute with the excitation number? So, for example, if you have a certain number of excitations, and then
it very definitely does not commute. That is, new excitations are being generated.
How do you restrict the space then?
Through the finite duration of the experiment, first of all. They're usually quite short on the scale of interactions we encounter, and B, high spin states relax very quickly. That is, in principle, when you start climbing up and up and up and up, relaxation is your best friend because there is eventually a soft cut. You wouldn't get any higher. This is how it works. That's a 10 spin system, so the exact simulation is a million by a million Liouvillean. Of course, if you just restrict it to single spin states, you don't have any coupling patterns. Doubles make it slightly better, triples make it better still. Quadruples with 300 states reproduce the exact result. Note that the phases are always correct. Furthermore, integrals are always correct at all approximation levels, and you don't need to go very high to reproduce. This is COSY, correlation spectroscopy two-dimensional NMR experiment. Exact one takes about 55 minutes. I had to do it in Hilbert space. The state space restriction produces the same result in Liouville space in about 14 seconds compared to an hour. So quadruples basis in this particular case, it's not particularly densely coupled system. We'll get to densely coupled systems in a moment. But two orders of magnitude speed up, three orders of magnitude state space reduction, and scaling is polynomial.
These are essentially different values of k?
Yes, this is k1, this is k2, k3, k4, and everything.
So I got lost on how you did the exact. I thought the point was, so in my mind, the point is with more than certain numbers of spins, you can't do it.
And I cheated, essentially. I went back to Hilbert space, in which it's 2 to the n. So in principle, 2 to the 10 is just 1,000. 1,000 by 1,000 matrix you can handle. But if you've got relaxation superoperator, that's the problem. And we'll get to the systems that involve relaxation superoperators in a moment. Okay, that's another list, and this is clearly somewhere that we can no longer do that sort of cheat. It's a COSY simulation with doubles, triples, and quads. We've gotten significantly further than that since, but a 200 spin simulation of a COSY takes a few seconds with doubles, a few minutes with triples, and overnight with quads. And that's the B is here. That's a 26, I think, spin system. That's the COSY spectrum that you get. And this is the spin system, which I've chosen to mimic a real protein, so continuous belt of randomly selected J couplings. So large spin systems can be simulated in reasonable time on a workstation using state space restriction. We'll get to more complicated coupling patterns in a moment. Most 2D and 3D experiments we are working with Konstantin Pervushin on this can be simulated. They are decoupled in all dimensions anyway, so generally low orders are sufficient. And quadruples basis is almost exact. Phase and integral are always correct. That's another example. That's from magnetochemistry. Mary is magnetically altered reaction yield. That's the change in the reaction yield as you apply a magnetic field to it. 18 nuclei, including nitrogen 14. Exact simulation is just plain impossible. So we've done the experiment. And you can see in the practically interesting low field region, triples do describe it rather well. And we were able to show that as you increase the basis, the wings get better and better. So essentially, when you increase the basis, the description level improves. And asymptotically, as your basis becomes complete, you get the exact result. So it intuitively behaves like DFT. The bigger basis you have, the better the result. This is how we do it. Initially, what we want to do is A, we want to ignore the high spin orders, and B, we want to ignore the spin orders connecting remote spins. So if you take your spin system, create an interaction graph, what interacts with what, do a subgraph expansion, so expand it in a complete set of connected subgraphs, each of them individually is a small state space, and then just take a direct sum of their state spaces, not direct product, but a direct sum. clusters can possibly overlap, of course, so you'll have to eliminate repetitions. But what that could accomplish is it will retain the local states and the low order states, but it will discard the high states and the states connecting remote spins. You do quantum mechanics inside every cluster, and then describe, do the procedure which is on the next slide, cluster recoupling. That is, you actually smoothly recouple the evolution of magnetization across these clusters. So this new state space generation is you generate complete state list inside every cluster, and then direct sum without repetitions is your basis that is likely to be relevant. The procedure, well, as I said, naturally excludes what we want to exclude. Now, cluster recoupling. So locally, in each cluster, you can generate your Hamiltonians, you can generate your Liouvillians, everything, they're small enough. Then when you're generating the global Liouvillian, it's a procedure which runs as follows. If this is your local Liouvillian, and this is your local state space with some states in it, for cluster one, cluster two, and so on. And this is your global one, and the global state list. If you want an element between a state I and a state j, what you do is you look for a cluster which contains both of them, both the state I and the state j. If there is no such cluster, then the two states are simply topologically too far, and you write zero, not coupled. If there exists a cluster which has both state I and state j in it, you go into that cluster, find that element in the cluster Liouvillian, and lift it here. Take another pair of elements. There will be some other cluster which contains the cross term. Lift it from there. So essentially what it does is it collects the couplings from individual clusters.
Is there a guarantee that any two pairs of states always have only one?
Good question. It is in fact guaranteed. Because if you have both states in a cluster, then by definition of the cluster construction, the entire segment of the Hamiltonian connecting those two states is also inside that cluster. So if there are multiple clusters that host I and j, it is guaranteed, and we've proven that in the paper, that the element is identically the same in every cluster. It doesn't matter which you choose. So this cluster recoupling, there is no danger of element being overwritten if it's requested multiple times. So it's a unique procedure in that sense. So essentially, it collects coupling information from individual clusters about the connectivities that exist within the new basis set. Of course, it's not implemented like I described. The way I described it, it's understandable. But the way it's implemented is via matrix indexing in MATLAB, so the procedure is quite fast.
Just one more question, but it means that you have to keep at least the complete state vector.
In every cluster.
No, but the one of your...
The big one.
Yeah.
The way it is constructed is you take state lists of all clusters, put them together, and eliminate repetitions. So you never hit the original big exponential one. Because your clusters are small, the number of clusters scales linearly with the size of the system. So in principle, the only state list you ever deal with is the restricted one. You never form the global state list.
And then I don't see how you can couple different clusters.
Well, the states which this cluster had have migrated into the global state list, and so have their couplings.
But you're not actually calculating the global state, you're saying?
No. So this is... So, this list is the global restricted basis. That is, it has all those states, all the exponential number of states that are too high, excluded from it.
So you would, this matrix that's multiplying this restricted basis will essentially be block diagonal, each block being the highest size cluster?
Not really. Its structure is interesting. I've shown it briefly here. If you color each cluster, then you get a scatter throughout because there are repetitions between clusters. So let's say if you have two LZ, MZ, and spin L and spin M in a molecule occur in more than one cluster, what would happen is the intersection of these clusters would have to be excised from the resulting matrices to avoid double counting, and that makes the blocks interpenetrate. But essentially the story is you take cluster state spaces, which are small, you merge them together, you get a state space, the big one, which is still smaller than the total one. You then collect the data about their couplings from individual clusters. You've got, well, you've formed your restricted state space and the Hamiltonian or Liouvillean without ever looking at the full one.
But the fact that that you might have two clusters where both of them mm-hmm. are in both clusters means that the couplings are all strong within each cluster, right? And that means that these two clusters would be coupled very strongly.
That is correct.
So you might as well just take a big cluster.
Well, then the original state list, I mean, you're right. In principle, if we have two clusters which overlap to a great extent, why don't I take the bigger one? The answer is I've got to take care of this 4 to the n scaling.
Right.
And in principle, if the total cluster is size 8, that's the biggest that the computer can handle.
But what I mean is then you have to just use a then it becomes important how you
clusterize the system.
Yeah.
That is, in fact, the way it's done is we have a complete subgraph expansion. That is, every cluster there is taken into account.
But that's based on coupling constants, or?
It is based on essentially interaction connectivity. We don't look at magnitudes. If something interacts with something, has a node on the graph. So right now, the computational implementation of it uses J-coupling network. And if you've got an isotropic interaction, then just a network of anisotropic interactions to form the interaction graph.
So I have the feeling that, like in the MLG techniques for one-dimensional systems, if you have entanglement, mm-hmm. actual entanglement in the system, that limits basically the power of your construction because you need more states, and in the end you end up needing the whole space. So have you investigated the
I've looked at DMRG.
Entanglement to
the biggest DMRG has ever done is one-dimensional network of regularly coupled spins. I'm sorry, that's not real. As you've seen, we've got to do real systems. And the entanglement.
This is my point. You are telling us that your technique works mm-hmm. Without entanglement in the system. And my question is, if you have real and actual entanglement in the system, mm-hmm. will your technique still work?
Do you count the two electron singlet state as an entanglement?
Yes, certainly.
It does work with two electron singlets. In fact, it simulates the entire range of magnetochemical experiments I talked about. So yes, we include. I'm not certain what your definition of entanglement is.
It is not my definition. The definition of mm-hmm. entanglement is a state among.
So essentially, if you have this spin up, spin down, plus spin down, spin up, the T0. Does that qualify as an entanglement?
I think there's a little bit confusion. The point is really, he considers only tensor bases, but he still has entanglement because he considers all tensors up to a certain.
Because I can have linear combinations of states and tensor bases.
Particle entanglement, three-particle entanglement, or k-particle entanglement.
So, for example, an n-partite GHZ state, you couldn't get.
Well, if.
That involves a tensor product of k operators where k is extensive.
Well, you do that cutoff, but as I said, the very states that the quantum computing people hope to exploit, we are actually ignoring because they relax too fast and don't actually form unless you try really hard.
No, with the cluster coupling, in principle, you could still generate something.
Yes, with a big enough cluster, yes, but then it gets computationally prohibitive.
Even just if you have two clusters through the coupling between the two clusters, mm-hmm. you can still propagate that.
That's right. You can let's say if you have HNCOC alpha, you don't need a cluster that involves every single nucleus in it. Yes, you can propagate it sequentially.
And that will probably be more efficient than the direct coupling.
Well, that's what Konstantin Pervushin has found with his analysis. So my point is, I do work in the tensor product basis. That also means that I can form arbitrary linear combinations of states in the tensor product basis.
Within your class, within each of your classes.
Within the entire spin system.
So you can have up to order k entanglement?
Yes. In fact, the order actually varies through the system.
I'm completely confused because it seems to me that what before was said, this is what was called the kth order entanglement. Mm-hmm. You said no, this is not entanglement in the way it is normally defined. But now it seems that again it is. So I am so confused.
It is. I think what you mean by entanglement.
What entanglement in what physical?
What you mean by entanglement is such a sum. Well, they're mostly second rank in our case. So that's my basis. A linear combination is what you mean by entanglement. Well, in fact, my entire evolution happens in this linear combination space. So, of course, we do have. Otherwise, NMR simply wouldn't work. Okay, so an interesting byproduct of this is we've excluded the high spin orders. But it turns out that the nastiest part of our Hamiltonian was, in fact, those. Because when you try inverting or exponentiating or doing things to it, what you are worried about is the bandwidth. That is the separation between the largest and the smallest eigenvalue. It turns out that the largest eigenvalue that the Liouvillean has belongs to states of this type. Well, let's call them S. S1 plus cross S2 plus cross S3 plus and so on, plus cross. So essentially a plus state on every spin that's got the highest frequency you have in the system. By excluding such states, we have a byproduct of limiting the bandwidth of the matrices that we have. Because the states with extreme eigenvalues are the states we have ignored. What that means is that the condition numbers for large matrices improve dramatically. They become much more invertible, exponentials become easy to calculate, and actually what we found is vanilla Taylor series is, in this case, a much better way of calculating the exponential than the various Padé, Chebyshev, and the like techniques, because this doesn't involve matrix inversions. And really,
would it cut that off, that series?
You just do a metric test, not metric, norm test. So long as the infinity norm is bigger than something you included, as soon as it drops below a certain level, you say the series is converged.
I mean, Chebyshev doesn't matrix inversion either.
I think it does somewhere. It doesn't. Well, I may be wrong, but Padé approximation certainly does. Yes. I mean, we might actually, if it doesn't involve, that's news to me, by the way, we might just use it over the Taylor. But Taylor generally helps, because also L is sparse, and if you take certain measures to preserve that sparsity, things work pretty quickly. Okay, that's the statistics. So these are relatively small spin systems, but you can see the exact simulation would take forever and a half, and the quadruples is manageable. But interestingly, and we'll get back to that, the matrices are still extremely sparse. That's the density in percent, and it turns out, as I'll show in the second part of it, that this can be reduced further by several orders of magnitude without loss in accuracy. So it appears from preliminary data that the vast majority of states, at least in magnetic resonance simulations, can be dropped. Right, so just one approximation, carefully truncated basis set, correct phases, exact integrals, uniform convergence to exact result when you take the limit, 300 plus spin systems in favorable cases if not everything's coupled to everything, you actually have linear scaling. Right, before we move on, I've put in, I mean, from the practical perspective on this. Okay, is it now visible? Yep. That's MATLAB. So strychnine, 22 spins, cozy simulation. Count the seconds. So that's the relaxation superoperator. It's processing the total state space dimension in a 22 spin system. Turned out to be about 1600. Matrix density is still tiny. They're hugely sparse. It's done the propagators already for 2000 by 2000 matrix using Taylor series, and I think it's going to take longer to plot than it took to calculate in the eventual contour plotter. So you see the Taylor series does converge the propagators extremely fast because of this bandwidth in the spectrum, which got truncated significantly. Should take a few more seconds to do that. So you see it's all reasonably automated by now, and I'll be making it available in a couple of months, and if the NMR community wants access to it now, I can just give you the login onto the code repository. The propagator density, interestingly, is not much bigger than the density of the original Liouvillean, which is quite counterintuitive. If you do it via diagonalization or inversion, the propagators come out dense, but they only come out dense logically, that is, the system doesn't actually know the element is small. And if you do it with Taylor series and you take care to preserve that sparsity pattern, then your propagator isn't actually significantly denser than the original Liouvillean. Come on. Yeah, there. So simulation done, it's plotting, contour plots. There. That's a cozy over 22 spin system of strychnine. It has read a Gaussian simulation log, the full DD and CSA interaction tensors, built Redfield superoperator, including every cross correlation there is, and simulated a two-dimensional spectrum in less than, well, what was it, 5 minutes. There is another example of high spins. We've coded it in full generality. That's a coupling to uranium-235 in a three-spin system. We've coded shaped pulses, which the optimal control community would want. That's an 11-spin system involving nitrogen-15s, carbons, hydrogens, so I think a dipeptide from Konstantin Pervushin. Again, full relaxation superoperator in this case, and what it'll do is it'll do parallel shaped pulses. That is, it's going to do a 90 degrees Gaussian pulse on nitrogen and a 180 degrees, the so-called Q5 pulse on carbon-13. So there's a shape, the Gaussian, which does a 90 degree on 13C, and there is something called Q5, which is a complicated shaped pulse with complex phase patterns on nitrogen-15. And that's the diagnostic, oh, it's done already. Diagnostic messages here. We started with Z, on spins we were interested in, and you can see it inverted this spin, the coefficient's negative. It inverted this spin, the coefficient's negative. It left this spin intact, and it converted a couple of spins to SX, so plus and minus with equal imaginary coefficients, not SY in that case. So this and this got a 90, and that got a 180, 11 spin system. Well, you saw how long it took. Right, returning to the presentation. I mentioned that the matrices, even after state space restriction, are still very sparse, which suggests that further truncation must be possible. And the truncation we were looking at right now was based on the spin system connectivity. That is, what interacts with what in the spin system. And in essence, that state-based truncation would work under a variety of pulse sequences. In principle, if we look at every individual pulse sequence, then there are places where magnetization goes, and there are places where it doesn't go. So in each individual pulse sequence, there must be scope for further truncation based on the states that are actually populated and passed through. So spin dynamics trajectory groups theoretically is a propagator group orbit. That's an action by a propagator on the initial state vector at all times. In discrete simulations, this orbit is discretized. You have individual elements and propagator, propagator squared, and so on. So that's the sequence of density matrices through which your system evolves. And in principle, the space containing this trajectory up to step n, if we only do n-step simulation, should be sufficient. So if we take that trajectory and orthogonalize it, the resulting basis is likely to be smaller in the full state space, and in fact it usually is. But this mathematical object is known as the n-Skrylov subspace, generated by this propagator and the initial state vector. In principle, you remember that exponential expression for the propagator. It contains powers of the Liouvillean. So this space is a subspace of this, because these powers of the Liouvillean do occur in the expressions for the propagator, but it's much easier to calculate because the Liouvillean matrix we already have, and it's slightly sparser as well than P. So if we calculate this and project the spin system into that, the simulation size is likely to be reduced. That was originally proposed by Jack Fried. This he called Lanzerspruning, and we sort of traced the path from the original simulation into it. So the idea is the system trajectory at any given time in the sequence is actually confined to reasonably small subspace of the full state space, and if we manage to map them out in a computationally efficient way, the simulation size is likely to be reduced. So the naive way is, of course, to propagate the spin system for as long as you want, orthogonalize the trajectory, but then, of course, in order to reduce, you need to run the exact simulation, which is not what we want to do. So we found some basis screening procedures which avoid the exact simulation. So this is, again, in the paper, but what we managed to prove that if you take a short length of the trajectory and a given vector doesn't appear here, then it will never appear. So it turns out that if you take, for example, 10 steps of the trajectory and something doesn't enter, with high probability it will never enter. And the probability goes exponentially with the number of steps. There is a proof. There is also a thin track theorem, which says that if it enters but with very small amplitude, then we can still ignore it. And that would amount effectively to a procedure that looks similar to this. So what essentially you do is you
can you go back and just see how much can you ignore it? I mean, what's epsilon?
Epsilon is set by the user. It is the level of truncation at which you are comfortable, and in general it is selected at the level where it matches the experiment. When it stops matching the experiment, things go wrong, but it's a user selectable cutoff. We've implemented a safe value into the code, but you can actually shift it around if you're feeling brave. Right, so the way it's done is you do several initial steps, and for that you don't need to compute the matrix exponentials. There are Krylov subspace propagation techniques which form rho n plus 1 directly from L and rho. You detect the tracks which have remained zero, so generates a zero track mask, and then you just strike the corresponding rows and columns out of the Liouvillean. The result is that reduced dimensionality matrix. And this is where this Liouville space really shines, because it would not have been possible to do that procedure using this propagation. Whereas it is easily possible, because if you puncture an element out of rho, it's still a matrix, it's not compressible. But if you kill an element in a rho vector just shrinks. Right, so that's the updated table. Up to 200 spin system, it takes the age of the universe to simulate a 200 spin system exactly. State space restriction to 4 spin orders plus the zero track elimination gets it to several thousand, and now the matrices are actually reasonably dense. meaning that, well, truncation is complete.
What effect on 4 or 5 or something like that?
Yes, in the dimension, but bear in mind that matrix operations scale cubically. That's an order of magnitude in the actual calculation. Right. I think I had some examples. That's a slightly denser coupled 10-spin system. A lot is coupled to a lot of other spins here. Initial very big matrix after state space restriction gets down to 300 by 300. After zero track elimination, you get a dense matrix 75 by 75. I think if you truncate, 75 is too dramatic. But if you keep it at 280, you see there is no difference down to 10 to the minus 6. With the exact calculation. I think this 75 refers to a different picture here. But the fact that just 200 states, 300 states out of a million are actually necessary is quite remarkable. That's another example. This time it's a densely coupled spin system where everything is actually coupled to everything else. I've deliberately generated a 5-spin system in which every single J-coupling star-shaped topology is non-zero, randomly selected, so not equal, no regular, so no cheating, basically. Real, proper, fully densely coupled 5-spin system. Exact simulation in a 5-spin system is 1,000 states, and you can reasonably go to about 100. In fact, if you do it Jack Fried style with Lanzer-Sprüning, the envelope is more or less reproduced down to n equals 80, and that, I think, is the reason why the fringe group have their powder patterns and long-term evolution patterns correct. So, in principle, if you average over very many instances of simulation at different orientation, chances are you'll get the envelope right, whereas each individual crystallite is probably not going to be accurate. And that's the picture that I've shown previously. So, Lindon's group is likely in this situation. In principle, what has been implicitly stated here is, well, at least I didn't say that, but it was implicit that L is time independent. It is possible to generalize it to the full time dependent case. I wouldn't stop on it, but if you read this paper, we were forced by the reviewers to actually generalize it to the time dependent case before it could be published. Right. Before I start with symmetry, again, a couple of actual codes. We've implemented symmetry factorization, which truncates the state spaces further, particularly in EPR. That's a 6 spin system evolving under the D4H symmetry. So the initial full state space dimension is 4,000 by 4,000. You generally don't want to run in such state spaces because really it gets a bit slow on the matrix algebra size side. But if you incorporate the fact that your 4 spins, 3, 4, 5, and 6, in this case, are equivalent, you can sort it out into irreducible representations. It'll finish in a moment. It counts backwards because it parallelized it. A quirk of MATLAB. There, your Liouville-Lenz block diagonalized, and you actually really need to only simulate the fully symmetric irreducible representation. Now, I'll do a bigger spin system and I'll just continue talking while it runs. We don't just work in Liouville space, that's a test in the Hilbert space, where it takes a 10-spin system and the direct product of symmetries, and I think it's got something like 100 irreducible representations there, and it'll sort them out. But okay, the way we could implement symmetry.
Can I pause 1 second because you kind of led into the question that I have? Because since you do Hilbert space calculations, I'm still wondering, since you can put relaxation into the standard, I've lost your term, Liouville space representation, and do this sort of U row, U dagger. Operation, and still in principle, and with all the you've presented, you can calculate those matrix exponentials in the same way efficiently, right?
That's right. That is correct.
So I'm not suggesting that here you've got a program that's written and you've done all the work to create this structure, and now you calculate them in a certain mm-hmm. way. But if somebody
can I do it in Hilbert space?
And use everything that you've learned and start with the regular Hilbert space. Could they just
me and my postdoc have spent the last 6 months trying to find a way back into Hilbert space, because as Niels Christian also pointed out, his code is Hilbert space. So if we do something in Hilbert space, it's going to be hugely useful. But there are two problems there. First, once you've done the restriction, the dimension of this matrix is no longer a square of any number. That is, it could be this dimensional, which means that decomposition back into H cross E minus E cross H transpose is not possible, because this is going to be the square root of the original dimension. So there is no way with the direct product decompositions. Another problem is, you remember that identity state, the wonderful identity state. We can say LZ cross E cross SZ, which says, okay, it's a two-spin order between these two spins, and we don't know what happens to this one. There is no equivalent in Hilbert space. In Hilbert space, you actually have to say that this is up, this is either up or down, and this is, let's say, up. You cannot say, I don't know, which means that the clusterization, the very reason behind the clusterization that you can actually say I don't know on certain spins in Liouville space becomes impossible in Hilbert space.
What if you do quantum trajectories? Quantum trajectories?
In principle, you could do the trajectory. You can simulate it. And then try and find such a Hamiltonian variationally as would reproduce the trajectory.
Yeah, because you can always do that.
Yes, well, economists do it all the time with their share prices. But it's just computationally intractable. We tried that. A doesn't converge the way we want it to converge. I mean, you have to vary every single element in this H. And again, if it's two spins, okay, but we've got to start with 20. So we are working on it. As soon as something viable in Hilbert space emerges, we'll publish it immediately, because we realize that, of course, the community is working in Hilbert space mostly. But so far, the state space truncation works in Liouville space only. But you see, the thing is...
Is that true? It only works in...
Let's say I don't know whether it works or not in Hilbert space, but
I think it does.
If you look at this, I mean, the dimension of your Hamiltonian in a 200 spin system is going to be a square root of this, so it's going to be 10 to the 50 as opposed to 10 to the 200. I mean, does it make a difference if the final Liouvillean is just 14,000? So the irony of it is, even though you work in Liouville space, the final dimension of your Liouvillean is orders of magnitude smaller than the dimension of your original Hamiltonian, even though it was originally bigger. So that removes the very reason why we should work in Hilbert space, that it's slightly smaller. In fact, the final Liouvillean is smaller still.
But this zero tracking, as we discussed before, it only gives a factor of 5 or something like that. If you see any data things
in
sort of could live without these.
It's generally a factor of 5.
This extra factor of 5, if you live without that, then everything becomes...
It's about a factor of 5 across the systems we looked at. From EPR to NMR to magnetic chemistry, it's always about a factor of 5. So in principle, yes, you can emit it if you wish.
I don't understand if I'm thinking about this correctly. I mean, I can see it from your example how it would be difficult to find a way back into Hilbert space, mm-hmm. starting with Liouville space. But can you use the same techniques you're using starting in Hilbert space in the first place? You have your clusters, you find mm-hmm. out which connectivities aren't relevant, and you even do the zero tracking.
In principle, yes. It's in progress. But yes, you can say that in a 200 spin system, the likelihood of getting a state in which all 200 are up is small. But the restriction criteria would be subtly different in there.
But actually, why do you want to do it in Hilbert space?
It's smaller. a bit, at least initially.
Just as fast or faster?
So even after all these reductions?
No. As I said, your final Liouville Villain is significantly smaller than your original Hamiltonian, so there's no reason.
So what would be the motivation to the Hamilton
space? For small spin systems, perhaps. Otherwise, I agree that there is no reason why you should do it. So if your Liouville Villain is smaller than the Hamiltonian, why don't you just stick with the Liouville Villain? I mean, there is a historical problem there. A lot of very high-quality codes, like Simpson, do actually work in Hilbert space.
But why is your Liouville Villain smaller than your Hamiltonian? Your Hamiltonian will be sparse as well.
Well, you've just done the state space restriction, you've shrunk the Liouville Villain. What's the corresponding Hamiltonian is, there might not even be one.
Shrunk your state space, why won't there be a Hamiltonian corresponding to that shrunken space?
Because the resulting, this is how you get a Liouville Villain from your Hamiltonian. And if this is dimension n, and this is dimension n, and this is dimension n squared, so dimension of L has to be a square of some number. As a matter of fact, the dimensions of L that we get are not a square of any number, so backwards procedure into the Hilbert space is blocked. And we looked at various ways of direct product expansions of it. There is no exact way in general to return. You have to do state space restriction in Hilbert space to start with if you want to continue working in Hilbert space.
Okay, that's what I'm saying. So why don't you do that?
We are in the process of doing that.
Okay.
Is that guaranteed to be completely positive when you do the state space reduction?
In what sense positive?
You guaranteed that on an extension of a state to something that's uncorrelated, is the evolution going to keep probabilities positive?
Yes. It is. It keeps the Hermitian, it keeps L Hermitian. It therefore keeps this unitary, unless you specifically require that relaxation is present, in which case it's controllably non-unitary. So we do not, as a spectrum of this, it remains a Hermitian matrix, so the spectrum is positive. Not positive, but real.
If you have to reformulate it, basically you're neglecting in the Hamiltonian the coupling to higher order than K correlations. So that's why you don't leak out of the space that you're restricting yourself.
Yeah, you're quite neatly packaged into a smaller subspace, essentially. And yes, it's unitary, and we originally worried about the fact that we're going to get leakages. That is, if you sever a coupling, in principle, the state vector might leak out of it, in which case you get non-unitary evolution. It's non-unitary in a nasty way. But it turned out not to be a problem. It's not. So long as you keep L Hermitian, the exponential of L is unitary automatically, which preserves the norm of the state vector in a good way. You saw the phases, actually. The phases I've shown, the first thing that goes wrong if you've got some leakage or violations of positive or, real definiteness, first thing that goes wrong is the phase gets twisted. And you saw that all levels of approximations actually have got a neat positive phase. Okay, it's finished with the block diagonalization using symmetry. If we go back into MATLAB, what it did, it was direct product of symmetries with 128 irreducible representations in the group, and it block diagonalizes the Hamiltonian in this case into about 20-ish individual blocks corresponding to irreducible representations of the direct product group. So you can see the codes got pretty far. Okay, but how we do it? So, okay, we've sorted the state space restriction, and at least in liquids it works. In solids it works with a question mark. You need big clusters, basically, because the connectivity graph is significantly denser in solids. You have to have higher spin orders. But if you go high enough, it does actually work. But high enough is a lot, really. Cluster size 8 or more is required in solids. But how do we do the symmetry factorization? In principle, it's a fairly standard, well-researched procedure. There's nothing new here, except for the fact that our basis is now something strange and restricted. We could do it Lie group style, just do collapse coordinate expansions, and then we hit the problem is some states are missing from these expansions. They lose their unitarity, bad stuff. Poor computational scaling, the NJ symbols have factorials in them, problems. Very complicated data structures. You have to have dynamically indexed arrays because you have multiple sets of L's and M's which do mutate when you add another spin. Anyway, we didn't even go there. And finite group styles. The chemists in the audience would remember the Huckel theory. How we symmetrize orbitals in electronic structure theory. It's transparent. It just takes your basis and does things to it. Scales linearly with the basis. Very simple general equations. And it looks like in the Liouville space, the only irrep you actually need is A1G. Come on. Okay. Now, why A1G? Your initial state, which is usually thermal equilibrium, is fully symmetric. It's LZ, 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 LZ. So if you permute equivalent spins, nothing changes. Your Hamiltonian is fully symmetric by definition. That's the definition of the symmetry. Your radio frequency and microwave events are fully symmetric. Your relaxation superoperator is Hamiltonian squared ensemble average, fully symmetric. Unless you take extremely special measures, the system cannot actually break out of the fully symmetric Europe. Malcolm Levitt managed to do that. He transiently introduced non-equivalence, mutated them into singlet, which is antisymmetric, and then reintroduced the equivalence. So if you do the tricks, you can populate antisymmetric Europes. But unless you do them, that is the whole of NMR, A1G is the only one that's necessary in the Liouville space. In Hilbert space, you have to simulate every single IRIP. So that's a very important point. You can get away with A1G only in Liouville space. In Hilbert space, you have to simulate all the non-symmetric ones, which is another reason to use Liouville space. So symmetry of spin system depends on what you're doing to it. If it's a solid state calculation, this is D2H. If it's isotropic calculation, that's S4, also known as TD, so slightly bigger group. And in many cases, the symmetry you're looking at is, in fact, not geometric. Seems to get stuck. So the way we implemented this is a state in our basis. It's a direct product of irreducible spherical tensors. We don't store them as matrices. We store them as index arrays, L and M. And in that case, applying a permutation to an index array is simply just permuting an array quite quick. If you have multiple groups of equivalent spins, you have a group direct product. So S3 cross S4, as you know, is much bigger than just S3 and S4. 15 IREPs, and there's a straightforward expression for the character table. You just do a direct product of character tables. So another final truncation thing, the one Hanna Hogben came up with in Oxford, is in principle you can directly trace the connectivities through your Liouvillean. Because it's a vector matrix multiplication, in principle you can directly see from the matrix what it connects to what. And you can trace those connectivities and then just block it out if there are some non-overlapping loops. So state connectivity, a bit like ray tracing really, computationally. It's a binary operation, so it's quite fast. Okay, examples. This is quinone radical, magnetically altered reaction yield calculation, full state space 4,000 by 4,000. After the state space restriction, it's 900 by 900. System's quite small, so benefit is quite small. After zero track elimination, 600. After S4 factorization, 79. After pass tracing, 28. That is still full exact simulation. We're not ignoring anything in this spin system. So, well, speaks for itself. It appears that even in small spin systems, most of the states are just never necessary. Cozy simulation of strychnine, you saw it run. Full state space, 10 to the 7th by 10 to the 7th. SSR4, that's four spin orders, and JNES is J coupling, J neighborhood of every spin. That is, if a particular spin has got more than four J coupled neighbors, then the system locally increases. That's the basis size. So if this spin is coupled to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, then locally for this spin, 5 spin orders would be included. So adaptive basis through the spin system. 8K by 8K as a result, full multiplicity, basically experimental cozy full match. final, I think it's a final slide, yeah. On non-geometric symmetries, in principle, any operator that commutes with your Hamiltonian is a symmetry because all of its exponentials are going to commute as well, so any such operator taken as a generator in its Lie algebra actually induces a uniparametric Lie group of symmetries. Infinite, of course, because theta is continuous. So in principle, every commuting operator then gives you a screening criterion. You can eliminate from your basis something that violates those invariants. Example is secular Hamiltonians commute with LZ, so your truncation criterion is the sum of your projection quantum numbers has to be static, and all the other states from the basis you can throw away, and that cuts about 80% of states immediately in Mary. Near zero magnetic fields, the spin chemistry codes conserve the total L, and so on. So essentially, in any big spin system, there's a huge number of operators that commute with your Hamiltonian. And every operator gets you a basis set truncation criterion, and we are currently looking at the most popular ones. Okay, software, you've seen that it's gotten pretty sophisticated. So the conclusion is matrix dimension actually required for most spin dynamics simulations are tiny. Astronomically sized matrices are completely unnecessary, and this is spinach. So currently written in MATLAB, code's open source. It is not yet completely finished. We might change syntax, but it's stable. Provides something that we called isomorphous replacement for spin operators. Not isomorphous, it's just an alternative representation. That is, all the spin algebra, all the exponentials, diagonalizations, things, they all remain the same. The only difference being your matrices get much smaller. So all the history of spin dynamics simulation is preserved with smaller matrices. Includes a generalized symmetry module. You've seen it, any symmetry of any number of groups of any number of spins, including high spin like uranium. Lanczos are Bernoulli time propagation routines, so you don't have to actually compute your exponentials when you're propagating. Generalized relaxation theory, module Redfield theory, multi-grid parallel soft pulses. We are working on the graphical user interface, and that's the current release date that we pledged to the EPSRC. That's the site where it all is, spindynamics.org, and I hope it's useful. That's the story. Okay, how long did it take? Yeah, about right. Questions?
So to plot the real gains, you say you represent everything in this, with respect to sparsity in mm-hmm. these lists and things like that. But still you also obviously cluster the things. So what is the relative gain? How much would you gain by just exploring the sparsity
yes.
and not clustering relative to doing most? Because somehow
you will gain a significant pre-factor. It wouldn't change the scaling. But you've seen maybe in those tables somewhere quite how sparse those matrices are. I mean, if you take a 10-spin Hamiltonian in, let's say, a typical liquid state NMR, or even a typical solid state NMR, the percentage of non-zeros is tiny.
But that's exactly what you exploit with the sparsity evaluation, I guess. So
yes.
my question is more, what do you gain by performing the clusters? Because you have to form the clusters.
Spinach always, every single matrix and every single array spinach has is sparse already. That is, it's been designed from the ground up to utilize sparse matrix algebra, and there are in fact checks in every subroutine to make sure that sparsity is not lost anywhere. So this code I described, is only using sparse algebra. There is no dense algebra anywhere. And generally, if you take a typical 1,000 by 1,000 matrix and you're computing things like this, so if M is your matrix and you're calculating M minus 1 times V, you don't need to invert M and then multiply it into V. This can be computed directly. And if you make M sparse, as opposed to honestly multiplying everything into everything, orders of magnitude speedups, same goes with the exponentials. If you're calculating exp minus I m delta t rho, or psi, you don't need to calculate a matrix exponential. There are Krylov subspace techniques which take your M, take your Psi, and directly return your Psi at a later time. And again, if your M is sparse, there are orders of magnitude speedups compared to when M is dense.
But I missed the point. The gain of the clustering in addition to this?
Yes.
How big is that?
Well, the clusterization is a fundamental difference. That is, it just changes the scaling. So if you look at those tables, where was it? So this gain from astronomical to this is clusterization only. Yes, so not sparsity. This is the dimension of the matrix. That matrix also happens to be sparse. And that provides a gain, but that gain is purely technical. You just don't multiply that many numbers anymore. Yeah. So the fundamental improvement comes from clusterization here.
Can you compare your work to what is, for example, done in the International Spherax Group? Or they also use these method to reduce mm-hmm. your space to some lower tensors?
Yes. It still scales exponentially in their case. That is, in order to reduce their matrices, they start with the original ones. That is, all the methods which are... Well, they go under the general name of... What's it called? Model order reduction. There's a very large number of methods in electric chain analysis, for example. There is a large number of methods in hydrodynamics when you're doing compressible fluid flows on finite grids. Then the points in those grids are coupled and so on. But the entire trade there is centered around singular value decompositions of your original matrices. So you do an SVD, you throw the zero singular vectors away, you recompose the matrix, it becomes smaller. But in that case, you actually do have to have your original matrix to start with, always. And that means that the asymptotic scaling would be determined by the dimension of the original matrix eventually. So yes, it cuts the prefactor. Maybe it cuts it a lot, maybe by orders of magnitude. But what will eventually happen is this initial reduction step will hit a memory constraint because the matrix wouldn't fit into memory. This actually forms the reduced matrices directly without ever looking at the full ones.
I think this is wrong, what you're saying.
I may not be completely familiar with the work you described.
To what people,
but DMRG...
Dealing with the spin bath have done exactly the same sort of state reduction by saying you can restrict your system to just take into account mm-hmm. a certain number of simultaneously allowed excitations and then obtain the same scaling that you have obtained here.
I've looked very carefully at DMRG because, as you say, it rings similar. The best I've seen was a two-dimensional rectangular network of spins with all couplings equal. I'm sorry, that's not real.
No, but the idea of the theory is the same. I mean, the sort of systems that these mm-hmm. people look at is different from yours. That's true.
No, I have the impression that it's a fundamental limitation, that they actually hit problems when they start scaling their systems to non-regular coupling networks like these ones. So it actually does essentially depend on the coupling network being regular.
So your claim here is, you have developed a version of something which does what you do with DMRG, with MERA techniques, with all these ideas in regular arrays. Here your system, your method is specific to non-regular graphs.
I think they have developed something that is a special case of this for regular graphs.
But what do you call, maybe I'm missing the point here, what do you call regular and irregular?
Well, it's just, icing lattice and things. This is what I've seen in DMRG papers. That's the coupling graphs that they have.
Like with tensor networks, you can use any graph. It just won't be efficient for graphs unless they have sort of nested tree structures.
Mm-hmm.
but the method works for any graph.
Did you mean DMRG?
The tensor network formulation, which is something, I mean, it has a spirit, the same kind of...
Another thing, I had the impression when I read those papers that they're only looking at the ground state.
No, they can look at dynamics as well, but...
Have they?
Won't necessarily be efficient.
Okay, because my impression from reading those papers is A, they're looking at the ground states of those systems, whereas, and in the low temperature approximation, where the excitation energies are bigger than KT. The difference in spin dynamics is every single energy we have is much smaller than KT. So in principle, we do have to worry about our entire phase space being populated in thermodynamic equilibrium. That's another big difference. So it looks like I've got to read a lot more on DMRG. But
there is a lot which is coming out about linearizations to graph geometries, about dynamics, so it's really developing a lot.
So my original impression was...
That is a subset or a special case of what you have done, you know, maybe...
Because, of course, regular coupling network is a special case of this, you might agree.
But in the theory of spin bath, typically there's not a certain graph structure assumed at all.
But there always is some coupling graph, isn't there? It's a definition of a system.
Yeah,
it's
but not that you are restricted to a linear chain or something like this.
Well, as I said, can you forward me the papers that you mentioned? That would be useful.
Can you just explain again about the zero track elimination? I see it says you first case steps of the system trajectory. And what's the actual procedure?
You find which tracks are zero, kill the corresponding rows and columns of the Liouvillean.
How do you define a track as zero? If at any time?
Okay, the definition of a zero track is a state space vector, a basis element, with a zero coefficient, and which has stayed zero throughout that k steps. The definition of a thin track is the coefficient of that particular basis element has stayed below a certain threshold in the first several steps. So for zero tracks, you can rigorously prove they'll never appear. For thin tracks, you can say that, well, you can eventually conclude after a while that ignoring them corresponds to ignoring high spin orders.
So I'm still thinking about this difference between Liouville and Hilbert. So tell me if you think that you would agree with this statement. If I take a direct product, potential product of the basis in Hilbert space, I get something which is a perfect square. The fact that you don't have something which is a perfect square. But what would be the elements of that vector? That vector will contain all the diagonal elements and all the off-diagonal elements. And now it seems like what you're saying is that, for instance, you may be able to keep certain diagonal elements, but that certain off-diagonal elements never get populated.
That is correct.
Right. So and that's kind of your savings of going into the Liouville space.
Yes. In principle, yes, you're right. I mean, I've got the density matrix, and yes, there are diagonals, there are off-diagonals, and let us say that this off-diagonal element never gets populated. That gives me nothing, because how do I remove a single element? The matrix stays a matrix. Yeah, I get a Swiss cheese of sorts, but it doesn't get reduced. However, if I stretch it into a vector, that's a Liouville space formulation, these elements will be here somewhere. Then removing them is trivially easy. You just strike them out, they disappear. You strike the corresponding row and column out of the Liouvillean, the system shrunk. So you see, it's much more straightforward to do it in Liouville space.
I would like to comment on this. I think there are many methods in linear algebra which actually use sparse matrices, and they're quite efficient. And they can really use that some elements in your matrix are.
The problem here is not the fact that some are zero, some aren't. The problem is the sheer size of this thing. I mean, that's 2 to the m. So that's the fundamental thing we're fighting. Sparsity wouldn't help you there.
In your matrix, you don't really use the elements which are zero. They don't use any RAM.
Well, would you agree that you have to at least store the diagonal in any Hamiltonian?
if they are non-zero?
Well, a non-zero is a triviality. In a spin system, let's say you've got n spins in a magnetic field. Every single element on Hamiltonian diagonal is non-zero, except perhaps one. Would you agree to that? Okay, so we've got a Hamiltonian here, however sparse, with a diagonal. Well, that's the basic Zeeman interaction. Yeah, in NMR you always have it. So an NMR Hamiltonian always have a non-zero diagonal. That diagonal has got 2 to the n numbers in it. N equals 20, your computer crashes because of the out-of-memory error. Doesn't help. So you can make them sparse, it'll still crash at n equals 20.
Actually, you look at the Zeeman frame, so you can't say that you necessarily have any all diagonal states.
Yes, but there starts the state space restriction. So yes, indeed, the state space restriction, once you've restricted this spectrum, cuts it down from 2 to the n to n to the k, and yes, you can start working on it. And then sparsity does actually help. My point is that sparse matrices on their own don't help. They do help when you've got 5 spins, they do help when you've got 10 spins, when you've got 200, it crushes, because you have to always at least store the diagonal in the full state space.
I want to ask another question. I think there's probably can give a mathematical reason. You see, you start with your density matrix and you write it as a vector. And then your operations are now in this 4 to the n space. Does it in some sense mathematically help that your space is larger? Probably you can see more, or your symmetries can find the symmetries easier. Is there some reason for this?
Yes, in fact, it's a very good question. There are many reasons for that. A, you are right, the symmetries are simpler, because in the original Hilbert space, if you do a symmetry factorization, then every single irreducible representation is actually populated. It's not a problem if your group's abelian, because then your irreps are automatically orthogonal inside them, but if the group's not abelian, if it's got 2 or 3 dimensional irreducible representations, the state vectors inside are linearly dependent. You have to orthogonalize. And orthogonalization is an expensive procedure. So so if this is Hilbert and this is Liouville, so symmetry, in this you just need A1G, which is one dimensional. So when you start symmetrizing, your state vectors inside A1G are automatically orthonormal. In this case, it's A1G plus, you name it, all other irreps.
Can you explain what you mean by A1G?
As a fully symmetric irreducible representation, sigma G plus in the terms you may be used to. It's the fully symmetric irrep. It's the one which has the character line, all ones.
Fully symmetric.
And this does have some anti-symmetric components in it as well. So symmetry is much easier in Liouville space. Relaxation theory. Unfortunately, the best theory we have, for NMR at least, is Redfield's theory. And that involves products of this type. H T plus tau, rho, so double commutators of this type, ensemble averaged, and well, integrated over time, and essentially second order time dependent perturbation theory. But what it amounts to is an operator, a super operator acting on rho, which gets expanded if you expand it in index notation. R I J K L rho K L sum over K L. So essentially the result of the action of this R on rho is a two index sum, but you see it acts on these two indices and it returns two other indices. So essentially it's not something that belongs to the same space as rho. It's something that belongs to a space of super operators over the space where Rho live. So it is much more straightforward mathematically, if you're dealing with relaxation, to just say that that's a sum over M R M M Rho M. So to just translate it to a vector annotation. This is why the stretch. It's not something intrinsic to the theory, it's just the fact that the best relaxation theory we have happens to be living in Liouville space. There are some approximations in Hilbert space, but they are usually quite irregular. Kinetics. That is, if a chemical reaction is taking place whilst your spins evolve, again, it is possible to find the semi-empirical expression in Hilbert space. But the operators, if you look at the chemistry operators, would again take your density matrix and do this sort of transformation to it. So again, chemical kinetics super operators are straightforwardly expressed in Liouville space. This is why we like it so much. So it's an excellent question. Why are we actually bothering about going there? And it happens that the history of NMR theory, its most successful implementations are essentially Liouville space.
There's also some flavor in what you're doing of kind of a multi-configuration time-dependent R2-5.
In fact, we looked at it. It looks very similar to locality approximations in configuration interaction, because what really moved that field forward was the realization that not all excitations are actually necessary. That is, if you have some determinants which are either symmetry excluded, or they involve two electrons which are on opposite ends of the molecule, you don't have that sort of excitations. Excitations are usually local. So what configuration interaction people do is it's localization. They rotate it as a determinant till it localizes the orbitals, and then only use local excitations. The difference is they can justify the exclusions of those excitations much more readily than we do, because their excitations are high above KT. I mean, it's 1,000 times KT, it's electron volts that they have. And they can say, okay, at room temperature, this excitation doesn't have any weight because A, it's too high in energy, B, it's too remote. In NMR, as I said, every single state that we have is thermally accessible. So we only have to rely on locality. And we cannot have the full set of arguments that the configuration interaction people have. But I agree that it does look similar. They've got second quantized representations there. We are sitting in the first quantization, but there are analogies. As I suppose there will always be, I mean, all sorts of locality approximations exist in all sorts of physics. That's just another one of those.
Okay, so maybe we should stop here. Thank you very much.